This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3668 for Wednesday, the 24th of August, 2022. Today's show is entitled Linux in Laws SAI, John Hawley on kernel.org and other shenanigans. It is hosted by Monochromic and is about 92 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is an interview with John Hawley of kernel.org fame.
This is Linux in Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. Welcome to Linux In-Laws, Season 1, Episode 63. Martin, how are things?
Things are great. We had a very long weekend celebrating our monarch. Well, not our monarch, the UK monarch.
I suppose. Do you own one yourself? I wonder.
Sure. Well, she is for all the people. So yeah, I guess we all own a part of her.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for the greater audience, we're recording this in June of 2027. If memory serves correct, and Martin is referring to the, what is Martin, 102nd or whatever anniversary, right?
Oh no,
maybe I'm wrong.
27,
20,
yeah.
Maybe 100.
Yeah,
maybe
it'll be over 100. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, fair enough. So she's done well, but then a lot of taxpayers' money is poured into that sort of thing, isn't it? Including yours, I might add.
It's a good cause.
But exactly,
unlike some others.
But Martin, given the fact that you are the royalist between the two of us, that makes sense.
It's quite difficult for a German to be a royalist, I guess.
Passing on. Martin, any plans of taking this over in terms of kind of just buying the whole thing? Not just for the tourist revenue.
No, I'll leave that to the people like Elon and whatever you need to take over the world. Yeah.
And given the fact that we're almost touching on politics, I heard that Boris, about, 5 years ago, was almost saved by the bell.
Is it that long?
This vote was on the 2nd, on the 6th of June in 2022, right? So, given the fact that we're recording this in June of 2027.
I don't follow politics personally.
You do not, fair enough.
It's not a very interesting subject. And it hardly matters who's in power. So.
In contrast to the members of the royal family, I'm tempted to add.
Indeed.
But enough of the...
Well, they give you bank holidays, right? So this is nice.
Well, that's true. And Elizabeth and the firm, if you're listening... The email address is, if you want to get involved, the email address is sponsor@linuxinlaws.eu. Yes. Please get in touch, and we're more than happy to bash you even further.
Do an interview with her, indeed.
But this is not about the royal family of the country that Martin chooses to live in, for reasons that escape me, but that's beside the point. But this is more like much more important things, like the guest we have on tonight's show. Martin, you want to introduce our guest?
Sure, yeah. So tonight we have a guest from The organization I work for, which is VMware, but he's not here in disguise at all. He's here tonight.
I thought you were working for the Cosa Nostra. Oh, sorry, I'm not supposed to say that, right?
No, that was a few years ago.
Sorry about this.
But they're ancient history now.
I hope they know that too. not to say.
We can't mention any names here.
Yeah. No, of course we cannot. Salvatore, if you're listening, this episode is for you. I'm kidding. Okay, sorry, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm John Hawley. I work with Martin at VMware, and they asked me to stop by today and have a chat. And I have to congratulate the UK on their jubilee and their fine choice of seditious music that was continuously played against the Queen. Being from their colonies myself.
John, exactly. I take it you're not living in the UK. You're just living in one of the colonies. Okay.
Yep. I'm
an
often
ex-colony.
That ex-colony to the west.
That makes it Australia, doesn't it? I don't know.
Let's go further south, right?
Okay.
But yeah, the highlight of the Jubilee evening was Donna Summer for all persons. So there you go. Or the highlight, the end of the...
Donna Summer? Are you joking, Mark?
No.
How much money did
a surprise. Anyway.
Hang on. I thought she was dead for almost 30 years or 20 years. That must have cost a fortune in terms of reviving her. In terms of getting the genetic engineering right.
Well, she probably went to the great big freezer place as well. Right?
Okay, interesting.
Anyway.
Details made with the show.
Yes, we discussed this last time.
Donna Summer. Okay, fair enough. But this show is not about Donna Summer, but rather about open source.
It is.
So, John, why don't you shed some light on your past and why why you consider free libre and open source software important?
Well, I've been in kind of the free and open source software world since about 1994, which don't try and think too hard about how old I probably was at the time. But I've been kind of around Linux since then and ran kernel.org for about a decade and have done a whole pile of different things from network booting computers across literally the transatlantic pipes of the internet to helping get people into, coding and open source projects to, practically you name it. I've probably done something tangential to it. So, that's kind of the short and dirty of my background.
That sounds very interesting. For that one listener out there, I mean, it's a Linux podcast, but we should probably explain what kernel.org is, and maybe you can shed some more light on your role in maintaining or even administering or whatever, or running, for want of a better expression, of that most important internet site of them all. I mean, forget about YouTube, forget about Google.com, whatever. kernel.org is where it happens.
Yeah, so, I mean, for those of you who aren't familiar with kernel.org, kernel.org is literally the place where the Linux kernel lives. It is the master repository for Linus and half of the subsystems in the Linux kernel. It's literally where Linux, like if Linux had a physical place where it comes from, it's literally kernel.org. And long ago and far away, not too long after Peter Anben got kernel.org started, which I don't even remember the date off the top of my head, which is kind of sad considering how long I've been involved.
94, 95, maybe? Maybe I'm wrong.
I want to say like 95, 96, something like that. I'd literally have to go and find like Peter's old email about the whole thing to try and remember. He had me come on and start helping out with some of the things, eventually leading to me literally running kernel.org. And it's kind of funny, everybody thinks of, you know, anything on the internet as just like one computer sitting in a data center, and kernel.org was kind of a one of those distributed content distribution networks before we really called them content distribution networks, because we had machines running in on the West Coast in the United States. We had machines running in Sweden. We had machines running in Amsterdam. We had machines like literally all over the world. When, you know, Akamai was literally the only content distribution network that was that was literally bigger than us. So, but yeah, I mean, the Linux kernel comes from there. I mean, I remember the birth of Git and Linus coming and saying, you know, hey, I wrote this Git thing. We need to figure out how to get this running on the servers. I'm like, well, that's going to be interesting.
And of course, the most important subdomain on kernel.org would be wireless.kernel.org, because that's where the action takes place, right?
Well, I mean, there was an April 1st post I did a few years ago about putting kernel.org literally in the cloud on 747s.
Nice one. Nice. Okay. No, I mean, for the few people out there that are uninitiated, wireless.kernel.org is actually the place where, funny enough, you discuss wireless drivers for the 802.11 sub-framework within the kernel in terms of the code that maps your Mac full Mac device driver, but that's not a technical thing, to the rest of the kernel framework. And as probably some of the listeners out there will recall, there was a few, let's put it this way, shenanigans with the likes of Broadcom and other companies that put out drivers there that weren't exactly open source. And wireless.kernel.org, what it was actually the go-to place for alternatives, among other things. Full commercial plug starting now, wireless.kernel.org is actually the place where you can find the full specification of all of the wireless drivers in kernel, in the Linux kernel, including the chipsets that they support, which comes in handy, especially if you are in front of an older machine and wondering what the hell is happening and why doesn't my Wi-Fi work. But end of rant now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've got a laptop downstairs that I use daily that has one of those drivers. Mm. Every time I upgrade the kernel, it's an adventure.
I think you mentioned having fun installing Git as well, right?
So, I mean, I remember when Linus literally wandered off and came back with Git, and after the kerfuffle before Git. And, so I got to be one of the first people to get Git up and running in production on a server where literally the entire Linux kernel community needed to go and start pulling stuff and pushing stuff. And Git has this, if you've ever dug into Git has this really neat pathology that it works great on Linus's desktop or on his laptop. Works absolutely perfectly great because Linus has this, you know, these giant machines and has always had these kind of big machines. But the minute you start putting Git into production on a normal server kind of hardware, the whole thing just kind of grinds to a halt because Git uses so much memory to map things in and out that, like the Linux kernel itself, you know, at the time was 500 or 600 megabytes of source code in the repository, and it would balloon to like 8 gigs of RAM. when somebody did a poll. So, you can imagine in the early days when, you know, everyone starts trying to figure out how to use Git and everybody's polling constantly, that the poor machines that we had, which were fairly beefy machines at the time, they would fall over. And, you know, eventually with the advent of, you know, things like GitWeb and, you know, then we've got web crawlers also trying to crawl all of the Git repositories simultaneously. It was kind of a... an exciting mess, and new caching layers had to be designed literally on the fly and put into Git and GitWeb. And
I mean, is that when you decided to quit that?
No, I ended up leaving for other reasons. But, you know, there's in the open source world, particularly when you're kind of doing infrastructure-y things, there's always new challenges, new things. And the constant, you know, hey, I banged this together up over the weekend, can we try it, is the new production, you know, 10-year life cycle of software.
It reminds me a lot about the infrastructure behind Linux, something called linuxillos.eu.
I banged it up over the weekend.
No, actually, within 5 minutes or something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, let's be honest. You know, you point at anything any piece of infrastructure in the open source world, and that's literally how it's been. You know, there's a few people trying to keep the lights on and keep things running, and they're all doing, the people who are doing the back end work, they're all doing phenomenal jobs. This is not me trying to disparage them at all. This is me trying to promote them, actually.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, that these are unsung people that, you know, throw a coin to your sysadmin guys, because the people running the infrastructure do not get nearly enough credit.
The unsung heroes of this world, yes, exactly them. Yep. Before we go on to other topics, can you recall why exactly the VCS before Git was Bitbucket or something, right?
It was Bit something. I'm forgetting the name off the top of my head.
Details will be shown. But why did Linux get annoyed? Why did Linux get annoyed with this?
So Linux scale or something? No, really, what happened was the version control system that Linus was using at the time was actually a piece of commercial software, and gentleman who was doing most of who owned the company for the software had given Linus effectively a perpetual license to this, which was great for Linus. You know, it worked really well for him. Nobody else, I think, in the kernel community had a license for this, because nobody else wanted to pay for it. And at one point, being open source developers, people get curious. And we all know what happens when people, particularly open source developers, start getting curious. They poked at the protocol and figured out that the entire protocol, if memory serves me correctly, and Git is a bit old at this point, so my memory might be fuzzy. The entire protocol ended up just being like a telnet session that was all plain text.
Okay. Wow.
And open source developers, being what they are when they see plain text, started reverse engineering the whole thing. And the gentleman who and started like basically writing their own clients to interact with everything. And so the company that had the license to the original version control system got cranky. And things happened, words were said, and Linus wandered off and came back with Git and literally changed the entire version control world.
Iterations later, it was working a bit better.
So
nice.
I mean, I can recall one comment in some ancient blog, mail, whatever, that the design rationale behind Git was everything that Subversion wouldn't be. And it makes sense, because if you take a look at Git, never mind memory consumption or not, the whole thing is very scalable. And essentially, you're looking at one of the biggest open source projects on the planet. I mean, I just checked out 5.18, which is the latest, I think, release kernel, and it clocks in at 1.2 gigabyte, including the version history of said kernel sources.
Yep.
And we're looking at more than 1,000 contributors on a global scale, if memory serves correct.
Yeah, well, I mean, Linus knew exactly how the community worked, you know, when he went into figuring out how to write Git. So he specifically crafted Git to handle a completely distributed workflow, and how do you handle just the scale of commits and pulls and, you know, everything that Linux has to deal with. And I mean, you know, in some respects, Git was kind of very myopically focused on, you know, the Linux workflow. But then you've got entities like GitHub that came and sprung up relatively quickly and started trying to bring Git to everyone else, you know, trying to decouple it from just this tight focus on how the Linux kernel wants to develop stuff to, you know, how does, you know, not that Node.js existed at the time, but how does a random Node.js developer interact with Git? And I mean, you know, all jokes aside that XKCD will point to for on how Git works, which
he did, maybe the show notes. Yes.
You know, like you can get out of every problem you want with Git. There's two ways. There's the way that takes a long time and takes a ridiculous understanding of how Git works, and then there's just delete it and start over. One of these is really fast, but yeah, like it's Git is a phenomenal version control system once you understand that Git is plumbing.
Yes,
and it just happens to be a distributed version control system after that.
Yes. So, Linus, if you're listening, I'm not too sure that you are. A job well done.
Ah, you must be one of our five listeners, surely.
Maybe there's even six listeners these days, Martin. You never know.
You never know. That's very true.
Yeah, this is the awkward pause that's going to be edited out.
Okay, well, I'll
yeah, you know, some papers shuffling, you know.
Exactly.
What next?
I mean,
so,
I don't know. Why did you stop the kernel.org work, I guess?
So I'd been doing it for about a decade, and towards the end of my time working on kernel.org directly, so I left kernel.org in 2012. In 2011, August, day before my birthday, amusingly enough, we had a security incident on kernel.org, which actually kind of surprises me. It's probably one of the biggest security incidents that's happened worldwide that had the potential to affect the most people, and nobody knows about it. But from 2011
until today,
yeah.
Since we recorded,
that wasn't the certificate issue, was it?
No, this was some attackers actually got into the back end of kernel.org, and had actually, because of the way they had gotten into the system, they were able to not only get into kernel.org, but into a whole pile of other kernel developers' machines by bouncing through on the attack. And it was a fairly far flung attack. But from the attack, I spent 6 to 8 months just literally rebuilding kernel.org, and towards the end of all of that, I was just like, nope, it's time to find something else to do. Okay. Let's go find some other things. And I wandered off and went to took a vacation. That was amazing. I don't think I had a good and proper vacation in years before that. And then wandered off to Red Hat and worked on some OpenShift stuff for Red Hat, and then on to Intel to work on some open hardware stuff, and kind of been running around doing all kinds of other stuff since then, working in the open source programs office at VMware, trying to work on, you know, observability, and I've done some Ansible work and all kinds of bits and pieces, so...
Ansible, interesting, because that piece of software, if memory serves correct, is written in Python.
It is written in Python, vast majority of it anyway. So,
which brings me, of course, to my most beloved programming language. but Martin, why don't you chip in, given the fact that this is also your favorite programming language, if memory serves correct?
It's one of my favorite programming languages, yeah.
Indeed. But, if you're listening... You still have that fanboy base out there.
You're still welcome on the podcast. Yeah, definitely. Retired or not.
No, he's back at Microsoft, if I'm completely mistaken. He left retirement. Oh, right. Yes.
Oh, he's left retirement. Oh, maybe he has more time now.
Yes, he
mentioned to me that he didn't have enough time now that he was retired. So it's a good
point. No, Microsoft basically got him back on the payroll, and now he's doing, funny enough, Python work at Microsoft.
Yeah.
Funny enough, the very company that bought GitHub a few years back. Yeah, it's a small world, isn't it?
Indeed. I will admit, it's fascinating seeing how Microsoft has changed over the years. You know, going from the open source is the great evil to, honestly, Microsoft is probably one of the best open source companies out there right now.
They have at least two or three core contributors to C Python, on their payroll. Yes, correct. I mean, no, the days of the Halloween documents are long gone. I mean, you're looking at what? 20 plus years back.
Yeah.
And blatant commercial teaser, there is, of course, an episode
on Halloween documents. There is an episode. Yes.
Somewhere around Halloween. Exactly, yes. Details may or not be in the show notes. Exactly. No, jokes aside. No, I mean, you're absolutely spot on. Microsoft has been... I mean, it all came, I reckon, into existence when Satya Nadella joined the board of Microsoft, because he really turned the company around, being that closed source monolith to something called really open source friendly and geared towards flaws.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at any piece of commercial software at this point, you know, you will be hard-pressed to find one that doesn't have some sort of open source library or component or interaction. I mean, even the people who have a completely proprietary operating system today probably spend more time interacting with Linux machines than anything else, and they just don't even realize it.
True.
So, open source won.
Yeah, about 20 years ago, maybe 10.
Yeah. It depends how you define winning, right? We had a guy on the podcast first year, I think. I don't know if Paul Ramsey is a bit of an open source communist, but the whole open source is great and everybody uses it, but then the people that actually do all the hard work, like, you know, yourselves doing all this stuff behind the scenes on kernel.org and many other things, right? It's they don't see much of a reward for it, if any at all. It's kind of the point he was making. And then how sustainable is that going forward? So, I mean, there are obviously the projects that are company backed, you know, like the Redis's and the Confluence and
the OpenShift of the world.
OpenShift, yes.
OpenShift of the world.
PostgreSQL, yeah.
PostgreSQL survived, yes.
Yes, PostgreSQL survived. But then you've got the little thing that is sort of maintained by two people in a part-time basis, which makes up quite an important part of SSL communication and stuff like that.
You're not talking about OpenSSL now, I'm not.
So this is kind of, same at VMware, right? I mean, lots of the products have tons and tons of open source bits of software in them.
Tanzu, probably being one of the few examples,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's one of the examples. But even the things you don't think about, that look like, you know, commercial VMware products, they're based on they have open source components like Postgres and RabbitMQ and all sorts of stuff just to make them work to do the thing that they need to. Which kind of leads me towards what does VMware do in terms of contributing to these projects, right?
Well, I mean, VMware has kind of been in the periphery of open source almost since its inception. Which is kind of interesting because nobody ever thinks about, or at least used to didn't think, VMware as an open source company. But, you know, things like OpenVM tools and working in the virtualization stuff that's going on inside the Linux kernel. You know, yes, VMware has not participated in like KVM specifically, But, you know, VMware has always been kind of pushing, you know, either like the Linux kernel or for tangential libraries to help support what VMware needs. And even since I've been at VMware, we've done all kinds of things with, like, Turn. Everybody's kind of looking at the software bill of materials and containers and what's in containers and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, VMware obviously is in the container space. And so we actually started up a project called Turn, which is now part of the, I want to say it's part of the CNCF, but it's gotten kind of spun out into underneath one of the other umbrella organizations. And what it does is it tries to tear apart a container and tell you what's in it. Which, if you've ever taken a look at a container, trying to tear it apart and tell you what's in it is a shockingly hard problem to do, because just the creation of a container is kind of destructive, the way a lot of people tend to write their containers. And so...
CNCF stands, of course, for Cloud Native Computing Foundation, a subsidiary, I'm tempted to say, of something called the Linux Foundation, if I'm completely mistaken, for the one listener who does not know what that means.
Yeah. But,
as in,
you know,
the most essential infrastructure organization, I'm tempted to add, that is out there in the broader Linux community. Let's put it this way. So, if you have gained CNCF status, that tells you something.
But yeah, no, I mean, VMware's out there. We've got. I have literally lost track of how many GitHub organizations we have involved, but we've got Tanzu and. You know, we've got stuff in Ansible, we've got stuff, like, all over the place. Like, you throw a rock, you actually almost hit something that VMware has been involved with from an open source perspective these days. And, you know, it's, you know, what does VMware do from an open source perspective? Almost everything we do has open source in it somewhere. And so
I think of one project that is actually mainly owned by VMware, or owned, controlled by VMware, let's put it that way, which is the only one I can think of is RabbitMQ, where they are the predominant maintainer. But are there any others that you know about?
Pivotal. All of the Pivotal stuff is built on a lot of open source stuff. God, what else do we have that... Of course, now I'm going to have to, like, actually open up my GitHub account and see what we've all got for organizations, because that'll tell me. I think we've got like 50 some different GitHub organizations, so it's literally kind of crazy how many projects we're involved with. You know, we've got Concourse and Gemfire, all the Pivotal stuff.
Green Plum as well. Yeah, they were all.
Yep. Spring.
Yep.
All of the Spring stuff. Like Tanzu and all the other Kubernetes related stuff that we're doing there. Like we're all over the place.
For those few people out there who are still using Java, right?
I hear Java's still pretty big. I hear. I
don't know.
I haven't touched Java in years, but I hear there's like three developers. Yeah. I hear there's still like three developers.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting because there's this metric called Chiobi. I don't know if that rings a bell. It's a Danish company called The Importance of Being Earnest. And they run a programming language survey for the last 10 plus years. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. And for some strange reason, in addition to Python, Rust, and what have you, Java still features on the list very kind of at the very top position. But then if you take a look at any viable enterprise software ecosystem, Java probably would be among the five top programming languages that they use. So Java still has a stronghold in the enterprise world. And I reckon that won't go away anytime soon, funny enough. And so, of course, would be the frameworks that come with Java. I mean, if you just take a look at the ecosystem out there that there's out there in terms of Maven repos alone, or the Maven repo, let's put it this way, I'm almost tempted to say it's almost comparable to something like PyPy or crates.io or something. That, of course, being the Rust package.
Really? You haven't mentioned that before, have you?
One or two times, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, welcome to the Rust Marketing Podcast. Thank you. Rebecca, if you're listening, this is for you.
Needless to say, Chris is a bit of a fan.
Fair enough. But I didn't want to interrupt your flow. Yes. John, just go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, but no, I mean, VMware's all over the place. Like, in some of this just comes down to the open source that we're focusing on. You know, does, you know, generally help VMware, or it helps generally our interests. I mean, if you look at a company, that's kind of where they're going to focus their open source energy. I mean, if you're an open source developer, why do you do most of the work you do? Well, because something annoyed you and you're like, no, I'm going to go fix it. Yeah. like half of my own contributions are, gosh darn it, this annoyed me, and yeah, I went to fix it. Like,
it doesn't work.
Yeah, no, it doesn't work. You know, people joke that, you know, oh, well, you shouldn't code when you're angry, and I'm like, no, most of my code is done because I'm angry at the stupid thing for not working.
Exactly. Just fuck it. Just exactly fix it.
Like, gosh darn it, why didn't this work? You know, let me grab a sledgehammer.
John, fair enough. But on the other side, I mean, VMware itself is a big benefactor of the open source. I wouldn't say ecosystem, but landscape anyway. I mean, if I take a look at any of the big companies that I know running ESX and friends, sorry, ESXi, I think it's called these days, most of the guest operating systems would be Linux based.
Well, I mean, you look at any, you know, cloud on-prem, you know, actually out in somebody else's commercial cloud, the vast majority of the workload is going to be Linux. I mean, you look at most IoT devices, all Linux. Yes. You know, the vast majority of phones on the planet are either iOS or Linux. Like, you know,
take a look at the container ecosystem.
Yeah,
about, what, 95% of the user lands inside the containers are Linux based. More specifically, most of them, tempted to add, are Ubuntu based, and Ubuntu marketing has done a fine job of getting them getting that user land into these containers.
Well, that kind of brings me on to why did VMware come up with its own version of Linux to run their container images in? Just to mention for people who don't
know. Yeah, no. So it's Python or Photon. Yeah, Photon OS. you know, the reason VMware ran down that particular angle was we wanted to make sure from a VMware perspective that we knew what was actually in the container. And when something went wrong, we wanted to make sure that we had the resources and the capability of actually fixing it. I mean, you know, vulnerabilities and whatnot happen in software. I mean, let's be honest. If you write code, you write bugs.
True.
And
don't write anything. No, you can't write any bugs.
Yeah, if you can't write a bug in the software, in the language you're working in, that then is it actually a language? What you need more than anything in a software ecosystem is the ability to update things, whether that's your embedded device all the way up through your big servers and your applications running on the big servers, or into the containers. And so Photon OS gives VMware the ability to actually own the stack. So when something goes wrong, we actually have the ability to fix it. You know, and we don't have to wait for somebody to fix it. So let's say that, you know, some CVE comes out, and Canonical or Alpine or, you know, Red Hat or, you know, pick your favorite container distribution, is slow on updating. Well, what do? Do you fork that? Do you try and work around it? Like, there's so many of these, situations where kind of owning the distribution, which for anybody who actually thinks that like writing your own and managing your own Linux distribution is easy, I have commentary for you, and it's not.
before we forget, the two listeners out there who do not know what photonurse is, maybe for those who are not working at VMware, I'm joking. Maybe you could explain what photonurse is.
It's just a minimal GNU toolset based operating system. If you're running it on like IoT Alpine device. Well, Alpine has a tendency to focus on a BusyBox toolchain. Okay. Or a toolset, as opposed to there is a GNU toolset. And when I say a BusyBox versus GNU, BusyBox being a very specific slimmed down binary that uses a smaller libc to have a really hyper focused, very small set of tools. So, you know, tools being, you know, CD, chown, grep, you know, these really, you know, very basic tools that you would expect on a Linux system. Mm. And from the GNU toolset perspective, the GNU Foundation has a separate set of tools that most Linux distributions use. For completeness sake, the BSD folks have their own set of tools. Yes. And of course, everybody has a tendency to say or to call the applications that people want to run the same thing, you know, grep, for instance, except that BusyBox grep and GNU grep and BSD grep are all different.
Indeed.
they all take different fun stuff, exactly. Yeah, like if you've ever done any portable kind of work across these systems, like you're like, yes. Oh, well, I know that there's this command line option to find or something.
Yeah, slightly different.
and they're slightly different, or yeah. you know, minus system, I, yeah, the something on this one versus that one. Like they're all different, and they're all just different enough to be annoying.
No, I mean, as I just found out yesterday, XRX on BSD, full disclosure, I'm talking about something called macOS now, doesn't take minus small I, but only takes minus capital I. And Linux, of course, does take minus small I. And this is, I mean, if you're writing portable transcripts, yes, yeah, absolutely. This is where it gets annoying.
Yep.
And full disclosure, people, if you're running, for example, your typical router Linux distribution like OpenWRT and so forth, these systems typically come with BusyBox. BusyBox, of course, has the advantage of really being very, very, very small, typically aimed at embedded devices, but come at the price of limited as in reduced functionality. That's the trade-off.
And sometimes massively reduced functionality.
Yes, very much so. But on the other side, then on the GNU side, you have core utils. And core utils give you that full-blown functionality that you have come to love and expect from a Linux system. Yep. Indeed.
Yeah, and on an embedded device, you don't expect to be doing much programming yourself, right? So in like a container or something like that.
Martin, hang on. This is as minimal as possible. No, Martin, this is where you're wrong. Of course, I want to have a full-blown container runtime running on my router.
You do.
Same goes for Emacs, yes.
Yeah. Well,
it's because I can.
I mean, sure you don't want the Kubernetes cluster on there?
Absolutely. if you're listening, there you go.
Well, I mean, come on. You can run Linux on an ESP32 now.
You can.
It doesn't run very fast.
But the thing is, basically, can you run a container on that device? Probably not.
Well, you can use ESP32 has ST card support and FAT32. Hmm. So there you go. You can now have a gigabyte of storage space with your, 128 kilobytes of RAM.
So does the container runtime run on that device, I wonder?
I bet, if you poked at it right, I bet you could get it running.
I mean, all it takes is a kernel version newer than 2.6.19 that supports C groups and namespaces, to be precise, and then some dodgy software like Cryo, like Docker, you name it, and then you're off to the races, maybe.
Oh, there you go. There's a challenge for somebody. Get get a minimal Kubernetes running on an ESP32.
Yes. People out there listening, do not try this with Musl, but rather use a full libc. In terms of, you want to go for the standard libc library that comes from GNU, not exactly from Musl, because Musl might have some challenges supporting your container runtime. I'm just saying. Details may or may not be in the show notes. But before we lose that last listener, maybe we should go back to some more generic topics. John, I heard you're doing great things for the PSF, as in the Python Software Foundation.
Yeah, so the PSF, actually just about a month ago, named me one of their fellows this year, which is kind of an interesting aside, because I remember the first PyCon I actually went to, which my wife was was attending, and I wandered into the hall, and a friend of mine who's a kernel developer noticed that I was there, looked over and said, "Wait a minute, you're a Perl guy." And
nice.
Fast forward, a few years, and now I'm a Python fellow. But
and the marriage fixed that.
I'm sorry?
The marriage fixed that.
No, well, actually, it sort of did. The the reason the PSF named me a fellow was I don't even remember how many years ago now. My wife actually took over running the Python Google Summer of Code organization. And okay. For anybody who's not familiar with Google Summer of Code, it's a program that Google runs, has run every year, where they pay people to, up until this year, it's always been students, but this year it's opened it's a much broader set of people. It's anyone who's new to open source to come and work on projects for open source projects for the summer. And Google pays them to work on these open source projects. And Python has had what's called an umbrella organization. So it's an overall organization where other Python projects who may not be big enough to get into Google Summer of Code on their own can kind of come in. They can hide under our umbrella, and we kind of take care of the high-end administrative stuff. We help guide them, kind of help teach these other organizations how to interact with Google Summer of Code and these other things. And so I've been doing this. My wife took over the running this a number of years ago. And one of the first things she did after she took it over was realizing that I had some free time. She said, "You're going to come help me." And I'm like, "Well, okay." And the reason she told me that I needed to come help her was I had been working in Google Summer of Code independently on some of my own organizations for years as well. So I had a lot of experience. And so that particular year in Google Summer of Code, when she dragged me and a friend of mine, his name's Mefflin, we had 73 students under our umbrella organization, which if you've ever dealt with interns, having 73 different interns spread all over the planet and 140 some different mentors for those students, it is a fairly big job to try and just keep on top of what everybody's actually working on and doing. And so over the years we've she's been running it primarily, and there's a number of other admins, myself included, who have been working on trying to make this a good experience for the Python organizations as well as the contributors every year. And a friend of ours earlier this year, or actually I guess late last year, started pushing on the Python Software Foundation to recognize the efforts and the work that we've been doing in with this particular program, because we've been bringing in a huge number of contributors into these projects over the years. And we've actually got a pretty good track record of, and I don't have an exact number because trying to keep track of these numbers would be impossible. The number of contributors who have actually stuck with their projects after the Google Summer of Code stuff. And in fact, we've got several mentors that I know of, who started out as being in the program, getting paid by Google, and now they've stuck with their project and they're back, actually helping mentor, you know, students now. And on top of that, we've got a bunch of organizations that started under the Python Google Summer of Code organization and have actually graduated into being their own organizations in Google Summer of Code. So they learned how we did things, why we did things, you know, why we looked for stuff. And they took all of those learnings and went off, and they've gotten bigger, and they're managing their own set of students and contributors now. And so, yeah, the board voted earlier this year and said, yes, this is a huge contribution to Python. This is a huge contribution to the greater ecosystem. Yes, these gentlemen deserve this particular honor. And so, yeah, they made us both Python fellows. And, you know, I Python's a language, you know, I can kind of, it's an enjoyable language, but it's not my favoritest language ever. But Mefflin, it's actually really kind of funny with him. He's literally never even written Hello World in Python. And now that he's a fellow, he's literally made it his mission to never write Hello World in Python.
You could say goodbye world instead. Yeah.
That sounds like something he would write. I'll have to mention that to him.
What is your favorite language then? If it's not Python,
Bash, probably. If I had to, like, literally, the language I will probably go to the fastest if I ever need something is Bash. Unless there's some sort of a,
yeah.
I like Rust, but
there you go, Martin. Bash is faster. Okay.
How long does it take you to get something working in Rust versus does it take you to get something working in Bash?
No, we're getting somewhere, because you're talking about kind of toy software that needs kind of fast development, but I'm talking
it just
about
needs
like
to work for on a temporary basis.
Exactly.
Yeah, because the fastest way to production is exactly the temporary project that you never expect to run again.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I do a lot of infrastructure stuff, so Bash has a tendency to be the language
prevalent, yes.
Yeah, that you just go and you grab. You know, do I need to install an entire Rust runtime to get something running? No, because Bash is right there.
Yes. The problem is that people discover that Bash doesn't scale only about after a million lines of code.
Yeah, there is that problem. Bash is great for that thing that in your infrastructure that you need to just get done now. It's absolutely terrible for that thing you need to do 10,000 times across a million different machines. Mm.
Never mind 10 years later.
Oh, God. I remember working for one company. We built the entire build system in Bash, or in KSH. So for those of you who don't know, like KSH, okay. That's Corn Shell, which
yes.
is a, yes. a cousin to Bash.
Ancient, exactly.
Oh, yeah, like sun right. level.
Yeah, sun,
back in the kind of 80s, 90s, yeah.
And yeah,
But before we touch upon further on the subject of favorite programming languages, but maybe now is the time to plug the GSOC a little bit further, because, okay, you get cash from Google for spending a couple of months. And Martin, this is our plan B, because A, we're new to open source software, and B, we do not have anything to do over the summer anyway, right? So let's go for GSOC.
Well, it's only 12 weeks, right?
Well, this year it's actually more. The projects, they've restructured stuff rather dramatically this year, which should be very interesting and going to be a fascinating administrative problem for the admins this year, where the projects can be anywhere. I think it's anywhere from like 12 weeks all the way up through 24 weeks. And there's no set schedule for anything. It's all worked out but with the mentors and the organizations now. So,
but you just mentioned a very important term. It's just not the cash. It's also mentoring. And if I take a look at the GSOC ecosystem, some very important projects I'm tempted to add came out of this or were supported by Google or have been supported by Google. For example, FFmpeg was there at least for one or two summers. Yep. Given the fact that FFmpeg is probably deployed in about 99.9999% of the network-attached storages, consumer-based NASs, I might add, that's something to go by. So, but cache aside, the mentoring part is, I would reckon, even more valuable to the people participating in this.
Yeah, well, I mean, the contributors over the years, being able to come into an organization once a year and pitch a project and say, you know, look, here's what I want to work on. Here's how I think, you know, we can make, you know, FFmpeg or KDE or GNOME or, you know, XMPP or, you know, any of these organizations over the years. How can we make, you know, this feature better? This, as I said before, you know, why do any of us do open source? It's because something's broken and we're angry at it, or we just want it fixed. And these contributors actually get a stage to come and say, look, this is what I believe is broken. This is how I think I can fix it. And in the time period allotted, and they get a chance to, you know, pitch that. If the developers think that they can work with the contributor and over the summer, then yeah, they're brought on and they're given a chance to do this. And not only do it, but have the mentor's attention to answer questions, to be really hyper-focused on trying to work through this. Which is, if you're new to open source, the way the open source ecosystem works can be absolutely daunting. Because people are literally just out there constantly churning through things. Like it can be, if you're not used to it, or you just kind of look at it from the outside, it's just constant churn and people, you know, discussing things and arguing this, and you know, this bike shed should be, you know, purple instead of red. you know, kind of, you know, sometimes. And
did you mention spaces and tabs earlier?
Oh, I'm a big believer in the tabs, but you know, I won't start that religious war.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the contributors having access to the mentors and the mentors wanting these projects to get done, the contributors wanting to work on these projects, it's a huge boon to the new contributors, and gives everybody a really good framework for trying to help bring more people in. And I mean, that's kind of what Google Summer of Code was always about, which was, you know, yeah, the students get paid, yeah, the organizations get a stipend for mentoring the students, but that stipend that the organizations get, it doesn't even remotely begin to cover anybody's time for the 12 weeks of mentoring that the contributors are going to get. It really is, you know, get the contributors to the point where they're financially stable to actually work on this, and then everybody works together to try and get the contributor to the point where they'll actually stick with the community afterwards, is always the ideal, perfect, goal for all of these kinds of things. So yeah, none of us are getting rich, but we have had a lot of contributors over the years go through the program. And like I said, yeah, a lot of them have actually stuck around with their projects, or they've stuck around at least in open source, you know, maybe not with that specific project, but a lot of them have stuck around in open source.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not super familiar with the, I know the concept, but is this something where, let's say people work together on projects, or are they all individuals working on their own bits that interest them?
For the most part, just because of the way the projects end up getting, have to kind of get structured, the contributor tends to be working on their own in terms of the Google Summer of Code stuff. But they tend to be working in code bases where, you know, lots of people are working. Like if you're in I'm going to blank on like a specific project.
FFmpeg.
I mean, people are actively working on FFmpeg every day, and the contributor is working on a specific feature inside of FFmpeg. And while that feature might be kind of isolated with what they're doing, you know, like if they do a git pull, things are going to be changed, you know, every morning. So,
yeah, so I see what you're saying earlier is really getting people to navigate, you know, those projects or the world of open source when they're not used to working in those kind of environments, rather than as a team work on something that they're interested in. Yeah, got it. Okay. One thing we kind of vaguely touched on earlier on the container piece, but I picked up on one of your blogs a few months ago, and would you like to discuss a little bit about the Tracecruncher project that you?
Yes, Tracecruncher.
I do like that being not of the. Chris likes to use all these things at the at the lowest level possible, but for me, I like my life a little bit easier. So I'm quite a fan of this.
Tracecruncher is interesting. So if you look at, and this is going to take a little bit of background to explain why Tracecruncher is interesting. If you look at the Linux kernel, over the years, it has developed a rather rich set of tracing functionality built into the Linux kernel, mostly to try and figure out what's actually going on inside of the Linux kernel. And I say that, but people have this vision that inside the Linux kernel, everything is knowable, when hardly anything is actually knowable inside the Linux kernel, because there's so many different subsystems all interacting in completely different ways, and the ABIs inside the Linux kernel are always changing, because new functionality needs to be bolted in and this and that. And so the tracing subsystems inside the Linux kernel are actually really good for trying to track down what's going on.
So APIs, of course, standing for application binary interfaces, i.e. the interface that applications or kernel components use to interface to other components.
Yep. And so so things like ftrace and perf and all these other tools exist inside the Linux kernel. Well, there's a really interesting side effect of living inside the kernel is that the kernel is effectively one level higher from a permissions perspective than root, because the kernel literally has access to everything. And so when you think about it, there's fundamentally nothing different in tracing the kernel and what it's doing versus tracing a user space program that just happens to live on top of the kernel. And so kind of where Tracecruncher and a lot of the work that I've been working on lately is going is, let's start bringing these tools that are down inside the Linux kernel and exist and can trace things up into user space because they already can see everything. And let's make them easier for developers outside of the Linux kernel to actually be able to interact with these and use them. Because right now, or at least classically, these tools, you basically needed to understand how the Linux kernel worked to understand what how to get them to work and how to interpret the data that they were kicking back out. And so there's a bunch of new libraries that are being built up in user space to kind of facilitate interacting with these things. So trace command and kernel shark and some things like that, with kind of the long arch of where this is going is up into a project called Tracecruncher, which is a set of bindings currently supporting Python for interacting with all of these layers down below it, so that you can take a 20-line Python script and be able to start tracing things inside of starting to trace things on your system. Now, where this gets interesting, because I've said a lot of mumbo jumbo here that you know, like your four users are probably going to only sort of follow. But when you start looking at things that like containers, they tend to be very opaque because they run in their own namespace on the system, and so poking at them and trying to debug them can be kind of cumbersome and complicated, and to the point where a lot of the time when somebody wants to debug something that's going on inside of a container, they actually have to instrument the actual container itself. Now, if you've ever done anything in computers, the minute you instrument something, you've changed it. You've changed all of you've potentially changed all of the behavior of the thing you've instrumented. And this could be a problem, particularly from, like, if you're tracing down a race condition. just instrumenting it alone sometimes adds enough delay that the race condition goes away. Yeah. So this can be a problem. And what happens when you get a container that you don't have the source code to for some reason? You know, you can't easily rebuild it. Well, trying to get it instrumented can be really complicated. So what you can do with something like TraceCruncher is you can actually use all of the kernel tracing functionality to actually poke all the way from the kernel all the way up into user space and start looking at what that container is doing from what the kernel can see. And the kernel can see pretty much everything. And the best example of this I can give folks is a made-up example of, you know, let's say you've got a container, all it has is an Nginx process in it, and it's serving a static website. Yeah, trying to make this as simple as is humanly possible. And let's say the made-up scenario here is that it's serving content really slowly, and you can't figure out why. And obviously, this container almost has nothing running in it. It should just be lightning fast. And you start digging, you start digging, you start digging. You can't find anything about why it's taking so long. But if you look at it from the kernel perspective, because the kernel can see what's actually, you know, the Nginx process and the namespace and everything, with TraceCruncher, you can actually also see that underneath this entire container is a fuse file system. And if you're unfamiliar with fuse, it's a file system in user space. And file systems in user space have a particular performance penalty because of the context switches that have to constantly happen to go from the user space side of the file system back into the kernel space side of the file system. And it's just like basically playing ping pong as data goes back and forth. And this can, depending on your file system, this can be a huge performance penalty. And some of the container runtimes use this fuse file system to combine a whole bunch of different images into a single cohesive file system that the container actually sees. And you know, maybe that's where your performance penalty is. And if you were instrumenting this inside the container, you would never actually see the fuse file system underneath because that would be outside of your scope. The only way to actually see that fuse file system being even anywhere in that transaction is to look at it from the opposite end up. And so that's where TraceCruncher, and you can see all of that fuse file system and everything in that particular interaction. You can see all of that without doing any instrumentation to the container itself. Which means you haven't changed the container. You haven't changed the problem. Well, you potentially haven't changed the problem. It's still possible, like in race conditions, that even adding tracing functionality will add enough of a potential delay that the race condition will go away. But if that's your case, at least you know it's probably a really nasty race condition. But
this is purely empty containers, so there's no relation to more legacy approaches sometimes to apt, like the extended Berkeley packet filter or something called dtrace.
Yep, you could use both of those with, hypothetically, you can use both of those with TraceCruncher. We're still working out how the libraries get all the way back down from, you know, like Python all the way back down into the Linux kernel and being able to get data back out. But yeah, there's no reason that you couldn't use dtrace or eBPF or, you know, any of these other in-kernel tracing functionality to get information about anything that's running on your system. Containers just are a really easy, you know, nice example because of the inherent problems in trying to debug them. But in a hypothetical perfect world, kind of the trajectory we would love to see is, you know, great, we now have Kubernetes and we have the ability to trace, you know, a single system. Why don't we start aggregating all of this data across like an entire Kubernetes cluster? And now you can see all of the interactions of all of the containers from what each host system's, you know, Linux kernel can see. And you can start building up a really complicated graph of all of the interactions and how everything works and start seeing, you know, well, I believe that this got put onto the network wire, what actually got put onto the network wire, you know, what was received on the network wire, you know, how long did it take to actually traverse, you know, those kinds of things. And this is all functionality in essence that already exists, that is already, you know, potentially even on the system. It's just we need to wrap it in such a way that people can actually get to it. So that's kind of where TraceCruncher's coming at.
It's certainly a step up from kubectl get logs.
But you see, Martin, this container thing will go away within the next 2 weeks anyway, so
no sweat there.
Well, it's like the internet, you know. It'll be on in a week.
Maybe 1 month or something. But given the half-life of the internet, as I said, I wouldn't get up my hopes too high.
Don't bet the house on it, yes.
Exactly. Cat video networks are way sure a bet, I suppose. Anyway, but that's beside the point. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
But yeah, that's kind of the direction we're heading with those kinds of things. And I mean, it's a very nascent, you know, kind of field, is trying to figure out how to bring these things up. And there's a bunch of different people coming at it from completely different angles. And from an open source perspective, that's amazing. Because, you know, not only do you know that, great, we're solving a problem that other people are having, but people are coming at this from different perspectives. And, you know, maybe Trace Cruncher doesn't end up being the way that people go in the long run. But Trace Cruncher will influence whatever that final thing is, if it's not. And all of these other projects and all of these other pieces are going to influence how Trace Cruncher works. And it's definitely a fascinating thing.
We'll put the links in the show notes.
For those two people who are interested in tracing their Linux system, of course.
Maybe well, three, we did a whole episode about it some time ago.
John, the code is on GitHub, I suppose.
Yep. Yeah, it's on github.com/VMware/TraceCruncher. For that, and then a lot of the other pieces, depending on kind of where you're at, some of it lives on git.kernel.org, and some of it lives in some other repositories. But it's Trace Cruncher itself lives on up on GitHub, and so.
And let me guess, this codebase is written in Rust rather than C or some other language.
I was gonna say Trace Cruncher is primarily C and Python.
My worst suspicions have just come true.
I mean,
no, only kidding. No, these are the traditional.
We're not opposed,
right?
To somebody coming and working on Rust bindings if somebody wants to come and work on them.
I'm joking, John. I'm joking. I mean,
what I'm saying is, patches welcome.
No, I mean, given the fact that Python has found its way into the basic kernel configuration functionality already, anyway, so no sweat there. Yep. So I mean, if you want to build your own kernel, you better have your Python. You better have a Python interpreter at the ready, because otherwise you won't be able to do this. It used to be Bash, but now people apparently have moved on. Fair enough. Yes, interesting, very interesting. Of course, details, kids, maybe in the show notes. You never know.
Sorry, Chris, you had another.
No, actually, that was it.
Sorry.
That was the Rust question. Kids, please do check in about 2 years' time. Maybe the people who have come to the mites. No, I'm joking. No, a pull request are, of course, welcome. It goes without saying.
Definitely. Okay. So how do you see this going? I mean, we talked a little bit about what you've done in the past, and how do you see this going forward to whole? We have this question for everybody, right? The whole open source thing. So having spent the last 30, 40 years sitting here growing up.
I mean, open source isn't going away. Fundamentally, open source is just going to... Well, you know, it's like I said, it's like the internet, you know, it'll be gone in a week. No, but it's fundamentally, everybody has seen the value in how open source works, whether that be from something like FFmpeg to the Linux kernel to you know, Kubernetes or whatnot. And if you... Like literally, you point to a successful company and they're using open source. I don't think I think you would be hard pressed to point to any company, and say no, they are absolutely positively not using any open source. And if you look at how the trajectory's been going, you know, it's literally just been more and more and more open source that people are using, and consuming and contributing to and everything. what I would love to see is more contributions back from people who are using stuff. And I know that everybody says that, but you know, I know that there are projects and entities who are holding patches that they either don't know how to get upstream, or they think that upstream's hostile or something. And I would love to see the ecosystem somehow figure out how to convince everybody that no, that they want their patches. We want to see how things are working. We want to help you make your stuff better, because if you've already fixed a problem, you don't want 10,000 different fixes for the same problem. You want to fix it once so that everybody doesn't have to do this again. And so, you know, getting people's patches and getting their technical debt back would be the, like, in my ideal, you know, future, because open source is like, isn't going away. It's only going to get more prolific, you know. It's definitely interesting now watching how open source has changed in the years since I started, just because, you know, in the early days we all kind of had to figure out how all of this licensing stuff worked and had to be fairly knowledgeable about stuff. But now you've got folks coming up out of the universities or just getting into coding for the first time, and they sort of know what open source is, but they don't have like all the history and all the whys, you know, where are the bodies buried kind of stuff for all of this stuff. And it's fascinating watching them come at open source from their viewpoint versus from what I remember kind of being at the same point. And I think that's actually probably going to be one of our bigger challenges, is just trying to make sure that we pass on the knowledge about what, you know, open source is, how it works, why it's important, you know, why various projects have gotten to where they are, being as open source as they are, and so that people understand why open source is important. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, open source isn't going anywhere. You know, someday, somehow, magically, Linux is going to get replaced. I have no idea what it's going to get replaced with. But like it's almost inevitable, is that something will come along and disrupt the operating system space the same way that Linux did. And for all I know, there's someone out there right now who's literally just posted something on a random mailing list that said, hey, you know, this is some toy project. It's not going to go anywhere. And that will be the thing that finally dethrones Linux. Do I realistically think it's anytime soon? No. It's not like getting to where, you know, something as prolific as Linux or, you know, OpenSSL or anything like that. It takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of trust from the community that in the software itself. And that just takes time. So, but yeah, I think open source's future is very bright, and it's not going anywhere.
That's something what you mentioned just a moment ago is that, yes, people do fix bits of open source themselves, and as you say, they're a little bit wary to maybe contribute back or try and open the discussion with the project and stuff like that. So maybe that's where there's a bit of work to do, right? Everybody, you know, is more happily engaging with open source projects rather than just fixing bits and pieces by themselves.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's fundamentally a hard problem, because you know the hardest parts of open source are not the code, it's not anything, it's all people. And when you get down to it, an open source project it's literally just people. Not to make some really bad Soylent Green reference there, but and it's hard it's hard for people sometimes to communicate, because maybe this isn't English isn't their first language, or whatever language the project is being done isn't their first language. Text communication lacks any sense of nuance. Like, you know, throughout this podcast, you know, we've made, you know, random jokes and laughed about them, but how do you put that kind of an expression down in a written communication as well, and have the same meaning come across? And so people have a tendency to, like, text communication sometimes has absolutely ridiculous screw-ups and misunderstandings. And one of the things I've always said about open source is, you know, why do people in open source go to so many conferences? Well, 10 minutes and a beer or a drink of your favorite choice can sometimes save you 6 months of angry emails back and forth. And it's absolutely true, because if you can sit down with some of these people and actually discuss the problem face-to-face, sometimes the problem literally goes away. But if you try and explain it, like, on an email list or something, things just get lost in translation. And so, you know, particularly with the pandemic and all the advances we've made in telecommute stuff, I would love to see this filter into the open source world more, just because I think, you know, there's things like Big Blue Button and where people can sit here and communicate more freely.
Record
podcasts. Like, you know, there's a lot there.
That was a nice credo, wasn't it, Martin?
Sorry?
That was a nice credo, wasn't it?
It was, I like the idea of Linux being dethroned by something else.
Well, I mean,
it's not unthinkable.
It won't happen anytime soon, I suppose.
No, it's not going to happen anytime soon, but at some point, you know, some crazy new thing is going to come out and Linux isn't going to be the right thing anymore. But, you know, if you take a look at where Linux started and where it's at now, like the evolution it's had from from what it runs on, it is astronomical. Like, it's ridiculous how crazy where Linux started at running on the hardware it started on to now, like, it's literally running on Mars on a helicopter, and on
plus
hardware
two containers.
That could be,
in some random data center, exactly.
Yeah,
maybe three containers.
It might even be as high as five.
Yes, never mind these kind of small portable computers called smartphones.
Yeah, like it's hard to predict. Like, you know, I love the questions of, you know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I'm like, I can't even tell you what I think next week is going to hold, let alone five years from now.
My thoughts exactly, yeah.
like stuff is changing so fast and so rapidly. Like, you know, containers, you know, I remember I was at a Google Summer of Code Mentor Summit, and a gentleman walked up to me with a stack of Minnow boards that he had put together. And he's like, I think this might be the first test cluster of Kubernetes. And don't quote me on any of that, because I don't remember if that was exactly how it was phrased, but he did mention Kubernetes, and he tried explaining Kubernetes to me at the time. And this is maybe 10 years ago or something like that. And so I'm like, you know, oh yeah, that's interesting. And I'm thinking, you know, well, why wouldn't you do this with virtual machines or something at the time? And now look at it, Kubernetes, you know, cluster or containers are everywhere. So yeah, like, it's hard to predict the future. The only thing I can predict is that open source will be a part of it.
Yeah.
Everything's going to change, and open source will still be there.
Yeah.
That's something known in the trade as a safe bet, yes. Fair enough. John, that nicely leads us to something called the POXIs. And the POXIs, for those listeners who do not know, it's something that we discuss at the end of each and every episode. It's something that is worth mentioning over the last maybe 1 or 2 weeks that has come to one's attention in terms of, Martin normally discusses his new drug of choice. I discuss movies, TV series, what have you, but it really anything goes, books, never mind, or even politics, I don't know. So without further ado, Martin, let our guest speak first. What is your POX of the week?
Oh, what are the things I've been working on? I if you could actually see my desk, it's been
I have seen your desk.
You have seen my desk. My desk has been described as intimidating just because there's so many projects literally strewn across it. Actually, I guess the project that's been the most fascinating to me lately is a friend of mine who accidentally created an Internet Exchange here in the or out in the Bay Area. has dragged me back into doing Linux mirroring, and which I used to do with kernel.org. And yeah, so he's been kind of playing catch up on all of the stuff I remember from having to figure out on Linux distro mirroring. And I've been diving into how to collect better statistical information about what people are downloading and whatnot. And so I have this ridiculously messed up, like, Nginx log files into syslog getting passed around, eventually into a Python script that processes and shoves it into Influx, and then I can get pretty graphs out of Grafana out of it. And because when these kinds of projects, particularly with his name's Kenneth, because you can't just accidentally create an internet exchange in California, you have to, you know, start a new project. These kinds of things with Kenneth always spiral out of control and into very interesting places. Not only do we have one mirror system, but now we're literally taking these like little thin client things that you would normally just hook up behind a monitor, and we're throwing like NVMe SSDs into them and everything, and then shipping them out to random internet service providers and having them hook them up into onto their backbones, so that we can do these like little tiny micro mirror projects. And so now we've got like, I think we're up to four or five of these that are actually like live right now. And so we're collecting all of this data back, and I'm having to figure out, you know, how do I convince Influx to process this data really well, and, you know, get us some pretty graphs that don't take, excuse me, like an hour to actually show. And it's a fascinating little project. And it's fascinating watching Kenneth, you know, relearn everything that like he'll ask me a question and I'll be like, this is how it's probably going to have to go. And I'll explain, you know, all of my stuff. And he's like, okay, I'll think about it. And then he'll go try a bunch of stuff, and he'll come back and he's like, nope, you were exactly right. That is exactly how the world works.
I take it the code isn't on GitHub yet.
No, although I've got three or four people, particularly from the Alma Linux project, that have been hounding me.
Okay.
Yeah, who have been hounding me to get this kind of cleaned up and published, because they want the pretty graphs too. And I know when I
okay, like Ego and Friends.
Yeah. Okay. And at some point, I mean, you know, towards the end of my stay at kernel.org, I actually was working on a project where we could collect better mirror stats from all of the mirrors. And so it's kind of interesting watching something I kind of left, you know, a decade ago, suddenly cropping back up and being a thing again, and kind of seeing it come to fruition in a completely different way than I was expecting it to come to. So that's kind of that's my random project lately. Fair amongst, enough. You know, like 30 others.
Martin, what's your pox? Apart from the Queen has just passed her centennial reign ship, whatever, dominion, whatever you want to call it, or apart from the kingdom in dominion for the last 100 years or something.
No. I'm going with the VV this time, because it's something that I hadn't seen yet, but was actually very fascinating how that all happened. It's called Zero Dark 30, which you probably are familiar with, but I've never
seen it. Funny enough, I'm not.
Okay.
Can you elaborate?
Well, this is the story about how Osama bin Laden was captured. So,
okay.
Which
that's a TV series, or
it's a movie. Yeah,
it's a movie. Okay.
So definitely worth watching. Yeah. Because it's not just a bunch of Marines go somewhere. It's more about the whole build up to how they actually found him and stuff.
See. Like that. Okay, no personal involvement, I suppose.
I can't possibly say.
Fair enough. We're gonna leave it at that. details may or may not be in the show notes. I'm not talking about the movie now. I'm talking about Martin's involvement. Sorry, it's probably safe to say that details will not be in the show notes. Okay, which leads me to my pox. It's actually a podcast called Command Line Heroes, run by Satania Barak. Details will be in the show notes. She, for the last nine seasons, is a seasons. It's a podcast run by Red Hat. I used to be run by Red Hat, and she goes through a wide variety of subjects, from programming languages right up to cybersecurity and all the rest of it. It's probably worth listening to if you are not heavily technically inclined in terms of, because she doesn't go into the nuts and bolts, into the bits and bytes, but rather kind of gives an overview of what's happening in a particular technology field related to open source. So details within the show notes. As I said, it's been going on for the last 9 seasons. The podcast, according to her, is taking a break at the moment. Maybe Red Hat is tempted to revive it at some stage. John, thank you very much for taking the time.
No, it was a pleasure.
And hopefully have you back in the near future to talk about more riveting open source stuff.
Be happy to come back.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you. Bye.
This is the Linux In-Laws.
You come for the knowledge,
but stay for the madness.
Thank you for listening.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
Yeah, let me guess, you are on Pulse Audio.
I am not, actually. I'm actually talking to you on my Windows machine just because it has a slightly beefier processor and a 10-gig wired connection into everything.
What's Windows? Therefore,
Windows, it's a little operating system. Nobody's ever heard of it.
I see. Fair enough. Welcome to Linux In-Laws, Season 1, Episode 63.
Oh,
let's do it once again.
We didn't check with John how many hours of time he has.
Yes, very important. You have less than 10 hours.
I was going to say, it's 11 now. I can probably get to one without too much issue here. So I've got at least 2 hours.
Perfect. That means we can cut it down to 10 minutes, which is the average episode length. Fair enough. John, I'm joking.
Well, I was going to say, if I have to do this in, you know, 5 words or less, yes, no, maybe.
No, we normally cut.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.